what we've been reading all the way in the book of 2 Kings from chapter 1 all the way up into through verse 15 of chapter 8. That has almost entirely been standalone material that's only found there in 2 Kings in those chapters that we've been looking at. And primarily those things that he tells us about Elijah and Elisha and their work during the reigns of those kings of Israel beginning in 2 Kings would be the two sons of Ahab, Ahaziah and then Jehoram. And so we've been looking at all of those things. We have not been reading about the kings of Judah for quite some time as we've been looking at what the Lord has told us about the two sons of Ahab that were wicked and their reigns over Israel that took place in the days of Jehoshaphat, who was king of Judah. So the last time we were looking at the kings of Judah, we were looking at the reign of Jehoshaphat, and so we finished that. But then it's in what we saw last week, starting in verse 16 of 2 Kings 8, down through verse 24 that we read. It then covered the reign of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah. Now, as we have been seeing all along, 1 Kings, from Solomon's death, the book of 1 Kings and now into 2 Kings, the primary focus is on the details are about what was going on in the northern kingdom, those kings of Israel, those 10 tribes in the north, whereas the book of 2 Chronicles primarily puts the focus of attention on the southern kingdom, the kings of Judah. Now, do we read about anything of the other kings of the southern kingdom and 1st and 2nd Kings, or the kings of Israel, the northern kingdom, and 2nd Chronicles? Yes. But those are usually mentioned in terms of how they relate to the reigns of the kings that are of the primary focus of the respective books. So, which means we have been looking at 2 Kings for a while, so we haven't been reading much about what's been going on with the rulers in Judah. And what we do have mentioned in 2 Kings about them, such as what he says about Jehoram in verses 16 through 24, well, that's 9 verses that we have about the reign of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, as king of Judah. 9 verses there in 2 Kings 8. From verses 16 through 24. 2 Chronicles chapter 21, which is 20 verses long, so we have more than twice as much in 2 Chronicles about Jehoram. And everything that is mentioned in those verses that we read last week at the end of our time in 2 Kings 8, 16 20 through 24, every one of those things mentioned about Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat there, we find mentioned here in 2 Chronicles 21, but we also have some other details here in 2 Chronicles 21 that we do not find in the record of 2 Kings, chapter 8. Now, as we have noted all the way through here, it was not the Lord's purpose, very obviously, to repeat every detail in both books or in 1st and 2nd Kings, and also in 2nd Chronicles. Those things that God has revealed in those different books, when something is mentioned in one but not the other, they're additive. There's no contradiction there. There are just certain things that are mentioned in one that aren't in the other, but that are in the other not mentioned in the former. So that's the way the Lord has chosen to reveal these things. So if we're going to obtain the entire truth that God has revealed about any of these situations that have happened or any of these examples, we have to do what the Lord has commanded us to do and compare spiritual things with spiritual. We have to take what he has said in one place with what he has said in all the other places, put it all together, and then we get the whole picture that God has given to us. And such is the case here. So we want to go now to 2 Chronicles chapter 21 and read about the reign of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, who was the king of Judah, became king of Judah after his father. Now there's evidence that the beginning of his reign really was in the form of what is known as a co-regency before his father Jehoshaphat was dead. We find the beginning of his reign was in the fifth year of Jehoram the son of Ahab, it told us in 2 Kings chapter 8 and verse 16. So he began to reign at that time. And then we were told in 2 Kings 8 verse 17 that he was 32 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. So now we go to 2 Chronicles 21. Now what we do know about Jehoram, as it told us concerning what he was like in his heart, he was a wicked man, a very wicked man. He walked in according to the ways of the house of Ahab. He told us in 2 Kings 8 and verse 18 that we read last week, and we read the reason why, which we already knew about from actually going back to 1 Kings chapter 22, the beginning of that chapter, which is the one where Jehoshaphat was called by Ahab to join him in battle to help him against the Syrians at Ramoth in Gilead. And the reason that he went to help him there, an alliance was made between Jehoshaphat and Ahab. So this ended the years of conflict and warfare that had existed between the two kingdoms from the time after Solomon's death, when Rehoboam became king and the 10 tribes in the north rebelled against him, and then anointed Jeroboam the son of Nebat to be their king. And so that was the split in the kingdom, and they'd been fighting each other from that day forward all the way until Jehoshaphat's reign, when he made peace with the northern kingdom with Ahab the king. And the way that he did that, the alliance was cemented by a marriage between their the son of Jehoshaphat with the daughter of Ahab. Well, that son was Jehoram, and the daughter of Ahab was Athaliah, that we'll have the opportunity to read some more about in the next chapter in 2 Chronicles 22, Lord willing. She was Ahab and Jezebel's daughter, and Jehoshaphat married his son to Athaliah. And we've noted what a horrible mistake that was by Jehoshaphat to do that. And then the consequences from that very foolish decision that he made in that would reverberate for many years to come in his family, in his kingdom, in Israel. This was something that had a great negative effect spiritually on God's people for many generations. Because what it did to Judah was it turned Judah from following the Lord, as they had been doing under the reigns of Asa and now Jehoshaphat, two consecutive righteous kings that walked in after the ways of the Lord all of their days. But after Jehoshaphat's death, when Jehoram, his son, is king, who is married into the house of Ahab, he didn't convert Athaliah to serving Jehovah. No, it was Jehoram, Jehoshaphat's son, that learned the wicked ways of the house of Ahab, and he walked in those ways. And then he turned Judah to walk in those ways. So he was very evil. That's how he became evil, because of marrying into that wicked family of the house of Ahab, and he followed their ways. Now, we also read in 2 Kings 8, chapter 8 and verse 19, that God did not destroy his kingdom in spite of his wickedness for David's sake, because of the promise that God had made to David to preserve his kingdom. That's also going to be mentioned here, or is mentioned here in 2 Chronicles 21. So it was for David's sake that he kept his throne, and Jehoram sat upon it, and then his son Ahaziah who was an actual descendant of Ahab and Jezebel through Athaliah. He was brought up in the ways of that family, and that's what he followed, so he was wicked too. But God preserved the throne in Judah anyway for David's sake, because of David's righteousness. Nevertheless, the promises that God had made as curses upon the children of Israel if they did not follow him and keep his commandments, as we have seen that they had befallen Ahab and his wicked sons, Ahaziah and Jehoram, in that their enemies came against them and were taking away territory. There was famine in the land. Those curses came upon Israel. Well, now we see the same thing happening under Jehoram's reign, because he turned away from the Lord and turned the Lord's people to wickedness, as we read about here in 2 Chronicles 21. So, by no surprise, in fact, it shouldn't be any surprise at all, God was faithful and kept his promise. And so we're going to see the enemies of the neighbors of Israel that became enemies to Jehoram revolted. Edom rebelled against him, and he fought against the Edomites. We read about that in 2 Kings chapter 8, verses 20 through 22. And then Libna also revolted in verse 22. Now, that's a little bit different, because that was one of Judah's own cities. But this is also mentioned in 2 Chronicles 21, and there were others that we read about in this chapter, 2 Chronicles 21. So God is stirring up their enemies and bringing them against him, but it's because of this, his wickedness. And then he's going to meet a very gruesome end. We just read about that he died and was buried in Jerusalem. That's all we got from the account in 2 Kings 8. We're going to have a lot more details in 2 Chronicles 21 regarding his death. In fact, a letter was written to this wicked king, Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat in Judah, by Elijah the prophet. So this Elijah, his life had not come to an end when he was caught up in the whirlwind. This was during the days of Jehoram's reign over Judah, as well as Jehoram. So both Jehorams were reigning at the time when Elijah left this earth. But he wrote a letter, and obviously God inspired that, a letter to Jehoram, Jehoshaphat's son there in Judah, rebuking him for his wickedness and foretelling the punishment that would come upon him, particularly in the very horrible manner in which he was going to die. He was going to have a great sickness in his bowels, and he was going to die from that. He was buried in Jerusalem, but as we'll read, he was buried. They didn't have a lamentation for him like they did the other kings, and he was not even buried. He was buried in the city of David, but not among the kings in their tombs. So he died without honor, that was because of this wickedness of his. But it started right away, as we read here in 2 Chronicles 21 now. In verse 1, it says, "Now Jehoshaphat slept with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, and Jehoram his son reigned in his stead." Now, what's the first move that Jehoram is going to make after his father is dead? He's going to eliminate any and all potential rivals to the throne. Now, he's the firstborn. He doesn't have any rival, any true rival to the throne. That kingdom, Jehoshaphat gave his kingdom, his throne, to his firstborn son, Jehoram. So there was no reason, and there's obviously no justification for the action that he takes here. But Jehoram kills all his brothers as soon as his father's dead. So that's what we read about here in verses 2 through 4. It says, "And he had brethren, the sons of Jehoshaphat, Azariah and Jehiel and Zechariah and Azariah and Michael and Shephatiah. All these were the sons of Jehoshaphat, king of Israel." So here he has six brothers, and he names them there in verse 2. And then it says in verse 3, "And their father gave them great gifts of silver and of gold and of precious things, and fenced cities in Judah. So they all were given a very good inheritance from their father Jehoshaphat, all of his sons. It says there at the end of verse 3, but the kingdom gave he to Jehoram because he was the firstborn. Now this is a reminder of that system that was that goes along with having kings. That was not the case when they had judges like the Lord had designed for them. They demanded to have kings like the other nations around them. Well, what happens when a king dies? Who becomes the next king? Well, this is the pattern there. The firstborn son of the king becomes the next king. That's the convention. So when they wanted to have a king like all the nations, that would go along with it. There would be a successor according to that. Now, obviously, if there was not a, if they didn't have sons, then you would get into other ways in which the heir would be determined for the throne. But that this was the convention, and so this is followed there. Now we don't. He doesn't mention of Jehoshaphat's other six sons what they were like. Spiritually speaking. Now, in the case of David, well, of course, his firstborn son was already gone, but David gave the throne to Solomon, his son, because that was God's determination. But of all of David's sons, Solomon was the one chosen by the Lord, and David went with that, obviously. But God had chosen one that was going to be righteous in heart. As sadly, several of David's sons were not righteous. Now we're not told here of Jehoshaphat's of the seven sons, the other six that are mentioned there in verse 2, that Jehoram is going to have killed. Whether any of them were righteous. Now, considering that Jehoshaphat was. And there's no indication that any of his other sons married into the house of Ahab. Jehoshaphat's father, Asa, had been righteous. Is it a far-fetched notion that at least one of those other six sons could have been good, could have been righteous? And that's entirely possible. We don't know. However, what determined who would be king according to convention? Firstborn. And so in this case, we know the firstborn was wicked. I mean, obviously, Ahab was not going to marry his daughter and make an alliance with the king of Judah based on one who would not even be the heir to Jehoshaphat's throne. So it would be done on that basis. It was. But this shows us the way it was with kings. So being the firstborn son, that would determine who was the next king. What does that have to do with what kind of heart they had? Nothing. I mean, like in this case, you have, I mean, clearly he would have been the worst of the bunch, whatever would have been the, the other sons of Jehoshaphat, what they were like. It would be very difficult to imagine any of them would have been as wicked as this one that had learned the ways of the house of Ahab because he had married into it. But yet this very wicked son of Jehoshaphat is the firstborn, so he gets to be king. So they get the worst of the bunch. Well, of course, when God chose the judges, he always chose the most righteous one in all the land that would be the best leader for his people. So you cannot have a system that was better than what God had designed for them. But they demanded to have a king, and that's what they got. And the Lord warned them of those consequences of having that system. Well, here's one of them on display very clearly. They're getting a very wicked king to come after what had been two righteous ones, Asa and Jehoshaphat. Now they're going to get what up to this point would be, without question, the most wicked king that had reigned on David's throne. And what a shame to have a person like we're going to be reading about here in 2 Chronicles 21 to be a descendant of David sitting on his throne. And we can see why it says that God was endured that and preserved the throne for David's sake. Though Jehoshaphat gave that inheritance to all of his sons, and they were given fenced cities in Judah and silver and gold and precious things, But the kingdom he gave to Jehoram because he was the firstborn. So by what Jehoshaphat had determined, I mean, it was settled as far as the succession and who would be king. But it says in verse 4, now when Jehoram was risen up to the kingdom of his father, he strengthened himself and slew all his brethren with the sword, and divers also of the princes of Israel. So not just the ones who were his own brothers, but other princes in the land. You know, clearly anyone that he perceived as being one that would not be give him their allegiance or potentially could be a rival, he killed him. He murdered all of his brothers. I mean, what kind of person would do that? I mean, as soon as they become king, their first act is to make sure they murder all of their own brothers. Well, that's who they have as their king now. Do we see this kind of, would this kind of behavior be shocking from somebody that was of the house of Ahab? No. And that's, we're seeing those fruits now, those rotten fruits on display. Verse 5 says, Jehoram was 32 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem, and he walked in the way of the kings of Israel, like as did the house of Ahab, for he had the daughter of Ahab to wife. And he wrought that which was evil in the eyes of the Lord. Howbeit the Lord would not destroy the house of David because of the covenant that he had made with David, and as he promised to give a light to him and to his sons forever. So God was preserving David's throne and family, because any vengeance now that would be upon, I mean, if he wiped out all of Jehoram's family, well, the rest of Jehoshaphat's sons were now dead. So any judgment on the existing family would be very much a destruction on the house of David. So God is going to continue to preserve, even though now it's going to be through a wicked line for several generations, but he's going to do that because of the covenant that God made with David in promising to give him a light and to his sons forever. So it's for David's sake. And we looked at some scriptures last week where God is faithful to his promises, like he gave Canaan, the land of Canaan, to Israel and told them plainly it was not because they were righteous, it was because of the wickedness of the people in the land, and that God was bringing his judgment on their wickedness that had become complete, but also to be faithful to the promises that he had made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so God keeps the promises he makes to his faithful children, and we see that the passage of time does not have any effect on God's memory, and it doesn't cause him to be unfaithful at all. So we can very well secure and confident in that, and as we're serving the Lord, that we know that God is going to fulfill his promises to us also. If we will serve him, we do not have to be doubting, well, is he really going to give us the resurrection? Are we really going to be raised from the dead and be given a spiritual body that we can go into heaven with and be with him there? We've never seen that, but we have 100% reason to be confident and have faith in God. We have the proof of what God did in raising Christ from the dead and his promises to us to do the same with us also in due time if we will follow him. So we have no reason to doubt. Great is his faithfulness, and we depend upon that and have every reason to, as we see another example of that here. So verse 8 says, in his days, the days of Jehoram, Jehoshaphat's son, the Edomites revolted from under the dominion of Judah and made themselves a king. Now, Edom had been subdued under David, as all of those enemies were. But now that Jehoram had turned away from the Lord, what did God say? If they didn't keep his commandments, if they came and one way against their enemies, what were they going to end up doing? Fleeing seven ways. Whereas he said if they would keep his commandments, their enemies would come against them one way and flee seven ways. Well, when they came against David, who was fleeing seven ways? Not David, it was his enemies. but now with Jehoram, who's fleeing seven ways. Well, God is going to give a victory to Judah over Edom here. And so by this, I mean, Jehoshaphat is given another opportunity to consider why this revolt came. And it was because of the wickedness that he had done. But the Edomites made themselves a king. So they had been, in essence, what was a vassal state under Israel since David. But now they've made their own ruler. Now, we did see that under Solomon, that was one of the enemies that rose up against Solomon. So that was after he turned to idols. So having the Edomites start rebelling, that's been a very early sign of God's punishments to the kings there that ruled in Jerusalem whenever they were doing wrong. And so it happens again. And so then verse 9 says, then Jehoram went forth with his princes and all his chariots with him, and he rose up by night and smote the Edomites, which compassed him in, and the captains of the chariots. So they came, the Edomites under this new king, came against Jehoram. Now God delivered them from the Edomites prevailing. Now, why would he do that? Well, God had also delivered Ahab from the Syrians several times. Yet they continued to rebel and revolt and encroach on their territory. And it says in verse 10, so the Edomites revolted from under the hand of Judah unto this day. So that was a problem then that remained for Jehoram because of his wickedness. But was God going to... was he going to bless Edom to have them succeed in taking over Judah and Jerusalem? No, he wasn't going to reward Edom that far, but he did cause trouble for Jehoram, and this rebellion continued. So he had now perpetual problems from the Edomites, but we know the reason why. This was God's punishment because he had forsaken the Lord God of his fathers. And that's the phrase he's going to use in the latter half of verse 10. That's also going to mention the same thing we saw back in 2 Kings 8, verse 22. In addition to the Edomites revolting, it says, the same time also did Libnah revolt from under his hand because he had forsaken the Lord God of his fathers. Now that's interesting. What and where is Libnah? When did we first read about, well, as far as Israel's history in their land, Libnah was a city that was conquered in Canaan. So this is not, Libnah is not a nation that is somewhere bordering or in the near vicinity of Israel. Libnah is a city that is within in Canaan. And it was conquered by Joshua back in Joshua chapter 10. And so if you want to turn back there for a moment. Now, when we hear Joshua chapter 10, does that, just hearing that reference, does that ring any bells? Well, I'm certain it will. You will be familiar with what's recorded in there. But there's some of those chapters that it can be helpful to make a mental note, even if you don't know exactly what verses, like the Ten Commandments are in Exodus 20. Well, Joshua 10, that's the chapter in the book of Joshua that tells us about the sun and the moon standing still, one of the great miracles that we read about in the Bible. When Joshua defeated those five kings of the Amorites that came against, well, they first came against Gibeon, and then Israel had an alliance with them as they had been deceived to make in Joshua 9. But so Joshua went as he was required to do and fight against those five kings of the Amorites, and they were destroyed. And God made the sun and the moon to stand still at Joshua's request to preserve longer daylight so they could continue to pursue and destroy their enemies, those Amorites that came against them. And it was right after that victory over those five kings of the Amorites, those five kings fled and hid themselves in a cave at Makkada. That's in Joshua 10 and verse 16. And so then they came, all the people returned to the camp to Joshua in Makkada after he went and he killed those, slew those kings there. So that was the location of where his camp was and where they, where that judgment of those kings took place. He took the city of Makkada in verse 28 after the kings had fled there, and he came there, killed them, and then he destroyed the city. Now, the city of Makkada. So that was the, Makkada is where, right after that battle against those five kings of the Amorites, that was part of the immediate aftermath of that. Well, what was the next place that Joshua went after that? Well, that's in Joshua chapter 10, verses 29 and 30. Then Joshua passed from Makkada and all Israel with him unto Libna and fought against Libna. And the Lord delivered it also and the king thereof into the hand of Israel. And he smote it with the edge of the sword and all the souls that were therein. He let none remain in it, but did unto the king thereof as he did unto the king of Jericho. So this was what God had commanded. This was part of the judgment of God against those wicked Amorites. Their wickedness had become full, and so God had the judgment of utter destruction for them. And they were worthy of that punishment. That was carried out in Jericho, and he plainly mentions it there concerning Libna. The same thing happened. The city was completely destroyed, all of the inhabitants and their king, like God had commanded to be done. So Libna is no longer a Canaanite city, no longer possessed by them. They're all of their inhabitants are gone. So Libna then became an inheritance, part of what was given to Judah, the tribe of Judah. In Joshua 15, this is after the land is being now divided by lot to the tribes of Israel after Canaan has been conquered. And Joshua chapter 15 contains the details of what was given to the tribe of Judah by lot. And when we're reading about that, and it's a long chapter because Judah was a great tribe in their number, and they were given a vast territory there. But when we read about all of that, well, it included Makkada in Joshua chapter 15 and verse 41. When he's going through that, some of this follows really in sequence and concerning the really the path or the route that Joshua took in the conquest. But Makkada was mentioned there in verse 41. That was given to Judah. And Libna in verse 42. So Libna was part of the inheritance of the tribe of Judah. So when we're reading about Libna now in, well, we read about it in 2 Kings 8, verse 22, and we're reading about it here in 2 Chronicles chapter 21 and verse 10, that Libna revolted under the hand of Jehoram. This is not some foreign city. This is not some enemy on the outside. Libna is one of Jehoram's own cities. This is a city of Judah. This is part of the tribe of Judah, which is Jehoram's own tribe. So here you have a city that belongs to his tribe under his hand that revolts. And what was the reason? It says, because he had forsaken the God of his fathers. Well, that's the reason that God raised up the enemies on the outside, starting with Edom. He's going to mention some others that he's going to raise against him. But it's interesting here that you have a city of his own that were, these were the Lord's people. And Libna was a city of God's people of the tribe of Judah that revolts against their king. And the reason was because he had forsaken the God of his fathers. So what does that tell us about the people of Libna? I mean, these were some people who feared the Lord. And what did they think now about their king trying to turn their land into a land like the northern kingdom of Israel and all of that wickedness? And we're going to see the things that he did in verse 11. Well, let's look at some of those details, and you can bear in mind, what did the people of Libna think about these things that Jehoram was doing there? Well, he'd murdered his brothers, and it says he was evil like those of the house of Ahab, Let's see some details. Verse 11 says, moreover, he, Jehoram, made high places in the mountains of Judah. What was that for? He's bringing idol worship into the land, not just in Jerusalem, but in the mountains of Judah. So he's making this widespread through Judah, bringing idol worship there. Not only that, it says in verse 11, and caused the inhabitants of Jerusalem to commit fornication and compelled Judah thereto. Now, was this associated with some of that idolatrous worship? More than likely, there was a connection to that. But that's not uncommon to see in the practice of idolatry that leads into some of the so-called gods or goddesses that will be served by those who turn to idols will have a lot to do with the lusts of the flesh. And then there will be, you can ask, that is the case in lands today on our earth that engage in those practices. You can, you could ask Brother Caleb, he would verify that. They do those kinds of things. There are people engaged in those practices now in idol worship over in India and other lands. But anyway, this is what was going on there, and he was compelling it. So he builds all these high places. And what he brings in there is also introducing fornication into the land. And by the way, when Balaam tried to curse Israel to gain the money from Balak, the king of Moab, who was offering him great money to curse Israel because he thought he would be their next target, even though God wasn't going. They weren't a threat to him at all, but he didn't believe that. So he wanted them cursed by God. Well, Balaam tried three times to do it with his mouth, and he couldn't. God turned the curse that was in his mouth into a blessing for Israel. So then Balaam, that wicked false prophet, could not curse Israel with his mouth, God would not allow it. He came up with another technique that we read about in Numbers chapters 22 through 24, and it's even mentioned in Revelation chapter 2 in the letters to the churches of Asia there in the book of Revelation. That's why Balaam is also mentioned as the prime example of a false teacher and their motivation by covetousness in 2 Peter and Jude. So what Balaam did is something that God preserves as an example for everyone to remember for all time of what is the wickedness of a false teacher who intentionally was designing a way for God's people to stumble so that God would curse them, because Balaam knew that in God's law that God cursed them. The law of Moses cursed anyone who didn't keep all of the commandments in it. And so he sent women into Israel to entice them to worship idols and commit fornication. And so then God brought a plague in there and did curse them, as his law did when they did that. And that's how Balaam accomplished that. But he intentionally enticed God's people into those two sins, idolatry and fornication, in order to have them cursed so he could get the money. Of course, he got killed himself, Balaam did. But now, with that in mind, look at what Jehoram is doing in verse 11. What are the two things that he's mentioning there that he's bringing into the land? And not just putting it on the menu as an option for the people, but compelling it. Idol worship and fornication. So this is the level of wickedness. So he's spreading this throughout his kingdom and compelling it. So it's not just that he's chosen to walk in the ways of Ahab. He's determined to make everyone in his kingdom, all of God's people, to turn to this wickedness. Well, here you have one city in Judah, at least, that's singled out here, that said, no, we're not going along with this. We are not following these wicked ways. We refuse to do this. We're going to continue to serve the Lord, and we're not going to follow somebody who's bringing this wickedness into the land. And so here Libna revolted against their own king of their own tribe because of this. So that's an interesting but very good example from Libna. So that's They're mentioned there in verse 10 when he's also mentioning the Edomites, but it's a very different situation because the Edomites were wicked people, neighbors of Israel, those descendants of Esau. But here was Libna, a city of Judah that was under King Jehoram of their own tribe. And it says plainly that they revolted under his hand because he had forsaken the Lord God of his fathers. Well, that's a great example to follow, no matter what's happening, no matter what anybody is doing. And this is against the king. Well, what do we do? I mean, what do we do if we're in a congregation and the elders or the preacher or whomever brings in false teaching, brings in wickedness? What are we supposed to do? Do we say, well, they're bringing it in, we just have to go, I'm not going to say anything? Is that what we do, or are we going to be willing? Are we going to have courage? Are we going to be courageous? We sing those songs, are we going to be like Joshua and those others, and we're going to be like Libna, who had courage to a love for the Lord, a fear of the Lord. I mean, they loved goodness and hated iniquity enough where they were going to stand up against their own king. We don't know what happened to Libna as a result. Is it difficult to imagine what Jehoram at least would have desired to do with Libna, whether he did anything or not? I mean, what did he do with his own brothers when they hadn't done anything except for be born to the same father that he had? He murdered them. Now, what would he want to do with a city that says, you're wicked, we're not going to follow you, that's in his own land? I mean, he would clearly want to make an example of them. God doesn't say what happened to Libna, but it does tell us what they did and why. And we need to remember that, because no matter what happens anywhere, there's no excuse for us to ever go along with evil, no matter how many people are doing it, no matter how powerful or strong the leaders are that are pushing that. If somebody's trying to compel us to do wickedly, what do we have to do? We have to say no. We have to refuse to do it. We have to continue to serve the Lord. Well, what if they're so powerful like this king was? What if the consequences are, well, you're going to be killed if you don't go along with that? I mean, that we don't ever want to be in a situation like that. But the fact is, no matter what happens, we must serve the Lord, and we need to do so with all of our heart and soul and mind and strength, always, no matter what anybody else is doing, and even if that's going to cause us to be persecuted and to whatever extent it is. So very good example there from that city, but what does it say about Jehoram? We can see how wicked that he was there. Well, in response to this, verse 12 tells us that a letter was then written by Elijah. Now, we might ask, well, why didn't Elijah go in person? Well, we're not told. There were times that even when his life was being sought by Ahab, we know that he did meet Ahab in person. But there were other times when he could not and had to flee from him. That may be a factor here. Elijah's life may have been in danger. But for whatever the reason, the Lord gave these words of the Lord through Elijah the prophet to Jehoram in the form of a letter. So verses 12 through 15, it says, "And there came a writing to him from Elijah the prophet." So again, even though we've been reading a lot about Elisha in those chapters in 2 Kings all the way up into chapter 8 and more of that to come in the chapters that follow, we last read about Elijah in 2 Kings there in chapter 2 when Elijah the prophet was caught up in the whirlwind. But we know that this reign of Jehoram the son of Jehoshaphat began before that event of Elijah being caught up in the whirlwind. He's still alive. He's still serving the Lord as his prophet during these early years of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, and he's the one that God inspired to write this letter. "And there came a writing to him from Elijah the prophet, saying, Thus saith the Lord God of David thy father." Now, it's beginning with an emphasis on who his ancestor was. Well, he didn't... And he's also going to mention not just his most that more distant ancestor of his, David, but his immediate ancestors, his father and grandfather, Jehoshaphat and Asa. He says, "Thus saith the Lord God of David thy father, because thou hast not walked in the ways of Jehoshaphat thy father, nor in the ways of Asa king of Judah." So the three ancestors of Jehoram that he mentions are David, Asa, and Jehoshaphat. Is there anything those three had in common? All three of them served the Lord, and they followed God. And so he's pointing out, you're the descendant of these three, and they loved me and served me, and you're not. In fact, he says in verse 13, "But has walked in the way of the kings of Israel, and has made Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to go a-whoring like to the whoredoms of the house of Ahab, and also has slain thy brethren of thy father's house, which were better than thyself." So whatever it was, whatever his six brothers were like, we know that Jehoram was definitely the worst of the lot, but he's the one who's the king. But he killed these brothers who were better than himself and has turned Israel to following the ways of Ahab that he was walking in. So what was God going to do? So he's plainly pointing out, here are the righteous ones that you come from, but you've chosen to forsake me and what you were taught through your father and your grandfather, and especially your ancestor David. Now you're walking in the ways of these wicked Ahab and his family that you married into. And you're doing just like his family. So what was God going to do? Verse 14, "Behold, with a great plague will the Lord smite thy people and thy children and thy wives and all thy goods." So God was going to bring, he was going to bring punishment on Jehoram and his family and the people of Judah. It was going to afflict them because of the wickedness they were now doing because of what he had brought in there. In verse 15, he says, "And thou shalt have great sickness by disease of thy bowels until thy bowels fall out by reason of the sickness day by day." So there's the letter. So it's clearly pointing out what the problem is, and here's what God's going to do. There's going to be punishment that will affect his family and his kingdom. Now, that doesn't mean all of that was going to happen within the lifetime of all of them. Some of it would, that would affect his own wives and children. But, these repercussions were going to last for a long time, and there were going to be many punishments to come in the future that starts with what he was doing in bringing all this wickedness into the land. But then his end was going to be a gruesome one, that he was going to be have a sickness in his bowels and cause them to fall out. So we'll leave it at there. That's what's actually going to happen in the end of the chapter. What God said, of course, through Elijah, it came to pass exactly like the Lord said it would. We would know that would be the case, but it's recorded here at the end of the chapter in how Jehoram dies. But we will continue that, Lord willing, next week, our study from 2 Chronicles chapter 21 of the reign of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, a very wicked reign that we read about there, very sad. We'll close this hour here now with going to our Heavenly Father in prayer again.